This will be the third tape with Robin Masters on the 19th of March. Testing, testing. No, just to start. I mean, you might want to start talking about that thing you just mentioned.
I wonder if we did we cover that?
Well, to tell you the honest truth, I don't remember. I know you've told me about it, but whether we put it on tape or not, I don't know.
Yeah, okay. Well, is it torched off?
It's going.
Oh, fine. Well, during the time that I was with Lucien Dupré in Hairstall, we used to we were engaged in quite a few different terrorist, categorically, I think you'd say terrorist organizations and endeavors. The one I was thinking of with regard to the Jews, we used to monitor the export of Jewish kids from the main prison in Liège, which, if my memory serves me right, was a citadel. And we had inside information. We knew when they were going to do these moves. And what they had was a big van. They'd load the kids in the back of the van, and then they'd put the exhaust into the back so that the kids would be dead when they got them out in the woods, wherever it was they were going. And they used lime pits for them. And the only occasion I was involved in this, I had hoped to. Or we had hoped to ambush them, which had been done quite successfully in the past, and that was what we were going to do again this time. When they so we watched them from a point across the road or the street and down a bit so that we could see them without it appearing obvious about it. And it always struck me at the time, little kid, oh, 5, 6 years old, no more. And he had his little sister by the hand, and she's holding on to him, and she's got her rag doll clutched, and sitting there waiting, being told what to do by the German soldiers, and getting into the truck with the rest of the kids. And unfortunately, on this occasion, they changed the routing, and where we had expected to intercept them, they didn't show up. But this was a method that they used for a particular time. These methods would frequently alter. They might use that for a month or two and then come up with some other idea, or they might find they've exterminated the bulk of them by now, and that they wait until, the mop up. There's always the final few are always hard to get. You get the big swatches of them when they first started rounding them up, because they'd come voluntarily, or not voluntarily, but they'd say, everybody in a certain section report to the pickup point. You're going to be sent to work camps, and they had all sorts of grand titles. And or in some cases they did, or in some cases in the concentration camps, as opposed to the death camps, they would select people that were young enough or healthy enough to work. They'd go on work commandos, but then they'd just dispose of the old and the infirm and the children. That didn't seem they weren't prepared to wait for the kids to grow up until they were capable of doing any work. And then they'd underfeed them, to the point where you last 3 months while you're getting to be in the infirm group yourself. And it was only on the rarest of occasions when anybody had a particular skill that made them valuable enough to hang on to. But anyhow, we're getting into the camps, and I'm not into that.
Well, let's concentrate on your personal experience.
Yeah.
What did
Well, that was really the
when you saw this incident, let me ask you just one or two questions about that particular incident. They were just kids who were involved. It
In this particular
was only
operation,
just children. Now, when they were rounded up, you watched them from a distance.
Well, these, I don't know where they got the kids, whether they'd been held in the prison. They were held in the prison, but whether it was for a day or a week or until they got a batch, and where they collected them was anybody's guess. Our idea was to spring them if we could, and we did succeed on some of them, not ones that I was personally involved in. This was the only one that...
What happened when the group or people you knew of succeeded in springing a truck like this? What happened to the children then?
Well, they were taken into hiding and dispersed in various ways. Some went to farms and anywhere where you could put them. The ones that stayed in the city were very difficult to keep because they had to stay, you know, when they went underground, that was underground. They didn't fool around. You couldn't take chances, so that meant that you had people like poor old Anne Frank up in the attic for several years, you know, in one room. It's just incredible.
Was it just the Germans who were involved in this? Like, or were they assisted by the Belgian police?
Oh, you all, by the Belgian which?
By the Belgian police or whatever.
No, not the Belgian police. The Belgian police were pretty strict and straightforward. Anybody that messed around with the Germans, they were called Rexists, and they acted individually. You might get a Rexist from almost any walk of life, and maybe a few policemen were like that, but taking it by and large, the police are a pretty neutral sort of a group.
Can you remember seeing any Rexists on this particular incident?
No, I wouldn't have seen them in any case. They didn't come anywhere near us.
No, but when you were observing it, what I
mean? Well, you can't tell somebody's in civilian clothes whether he's Gestapo or just what he is.
So they were all in civilian clothes, you know?
Well, Rexists were just Belgian civilians.
No, I mean, when you actually observed this particular...
Oh, no, mostly Germans. I didn't see any... There were no civilians involved in it that I recall. There might have been one or two kicking around, but it's only a small little operation when you look at it from our point of view. There would be a truck about the size of a little bigger than a bread van. And you have a bench on each side, and you can jam 20, 30 kids in a place like that. This was their drill. So it was a quiet little operation right out on the front street. They could have made a run for it, I suppose, if little kids 5 and 6 years old don't understand that sort of thing. So they just stood quietly until they were told to get in the truck. And whatever they told them, they were going to take them somewhere nice, obviously. And then off they'd drive, and that would be it.
Can you recall any other operations that you were involved in this?
Not in that field. It was a little out of our line, except for I was never too clear on the structure of the various organizations, except the one that I told you about where they had the cells. That was a very efficient one. The one that I was in Liège was very loosely administered and the security was slack, and the liaison with other little groups operating on their own was apparent from time to time. Chaps used to come and visit Lucien. He ran it from his house as if it were just an ordinary business. You know, it's just incredible that he lasted as long as he did. But this murder incorporated type of operation, I think I mentioned that before. We covered that one with the using the doctor's car.
I don't recall it.
Maybe I was telling somebody else.
Can you remind me what it was?
Yeah. John is one fellow, Paul was the other. And they had a Ford car that belonged to Dr. Appledorn down south of town. He reported it stolen and turned it over to the resistance, who only used it on special occasions, kept it well hidden.
And I think maybe we did go.
They killed a Rexist right out in front of the Gestapo headquarters by driving up and jumping out, emptied the clip into him. Took him 3 days to die.
I think we have talked about that.
Yeah.
The second side of the last tape.
It could well be.
Yeah.
In any case, that group of people, I didn't have an awful lot to do with them, but they were the ones that also did this business of trying to liberate or free the Jewish kids that were being carted away. And our connection was that they came to us for arms. And that we did know a bit about their operation, and in some cases, one of our people would go with them or help them in some way, and that's how it was. I got involved in the in this Jewish children extermination thing. So I was not involved in that type of thing very much.
How long were you with this group before you actually managed to get out of Belgium?
I'd have to go over my notes, which I have. I think you must remind me before. I knew you were coming, but I've been so darn busy. You want to switch it off for a minute? Well, I was in Brussels. Just a quick recap. Landed at Mall, was there a day or two, went to turnout for the best part of a week, and then via Antwerp to Brussels, and in contact with various people in Brussels. I think I was there maybe 6 or 8 weeks, and then started for Paris. And that was when my trip was interrupted at the Belgian border, at Enghien, it's a little town there. And I came back to Brussels and was there a bit longer. And then they decided to try Liège, see if we couldn't get out from there. And it was in Liège. I guess I got to Liège around September. So it would be the June the 21st, that's July, August, and part of September. I'd say just split it about the middle. Mm-hmm. I was in Liège, in a Herstal, which is north of Liège. It's a mining and industrial area. For a time, then back down to south of Liège, and back up to Herstal again. And then to a place a little more central, and from there we left to go to Paris just as simple travelers, not as a organized group with couriers and guides and all that sort of stuff.
How many were you?
There were an American Englishman and myself, three airmen, and a woman, Mrs. Madame Joigneau, who is still alive, a little bit forgetful now, but in good shape. But she was quite a personality. I know we've covered her before, but she spoke German, Walloon, and French, and Flemish, all of us, as a native without accent. So she had a pretty free pass through almost any organization you want to talk about, because she could travel as one of them. In any case, she, on her own, and she'd be a woman about mid-40s, I guess, took us by train to Paris. We didn't stay in Paris. We kept going. We never stopped at all. We were getting a little tired by the time we'd finished all this. But we visited a doctor friend of hers and stayed there for about 3 or 4 hours just to burn the time until our train left. Did I cover the train bit?
No, I was going to ask you, what was it like crossing the frontier, and what kind of papers did you have? And
well, we didn't have any papers. What we did is we went down to a village just inside Belgium, got off the train. And when we got off the train, it was not a proper platform that you have in most of the stations in Europe. This one we had to get off out on the dirt between the tracks, and the train blocked the crossway to get to the station. And I had quite a start this time, and I'd been around for quite a while by now, and and I was getting a little bit more confident, but there appeared all of a sudden around the corner a whole platoon or squad of German soldiers. And they were merely being marched from A to B, but the way they came around the corner, they looked very menacing to me, I'll tell you. I guess my eyes must have got a little bit rounder than normal. Anyhow, that is where we got off before the train passed through customs into France. And then we had a local guide take us across the border on a couple of back roads. And it was blowing and raining and stormy and miserable. And I recall it's the first time I'd ever seen an umbrella blow inside out. I'd seen pictures of it, but I'd never actually seen it happen. That was crossing. The next morning, the weather had moderated a bit, and we rolled into a, hiked into a little village railroad station and picked up the next train heading into Paris. Got to Paris, got off the train, and Madame Joigneault must have known her way around enough. Or we may have been met by somebody, I just really don't recall now. But I do remember going to this doctor's house, and he spoke good English. And he was into reading the lumps in your fingers and the bumps on your head, and he was doing a little prognosis as to how we would all fare. And I guess he wasn't all that far out. But he's only dealing in our physical stamina, who had the most Englishman. He's a little short, wiry guy. And he got top marks for stamina. I got the middle, and Harry is a big, lanky American. He said he was a little worried about him even trying this trip. He's the only one that got into. Yeah, he's the only one that got into Switzerland as it happened.
The American.
Yeah. Well, we had a.
And you weren't carrying any papers, any ID?
Oh, yeah. As fake as a $3 bill.
Oh, okay. I thought you said you weren't carrying papers, which is why you kind of were smuggled across the border.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Papers, identification, carte d'identité, but no travel permits or anything like that. That was the weak point.
Okay, I understand.
Yeah. Well, Madame Legrand took us to Dole, and then I don't remember if she took us on to Dijon or Besançon or not. Dole, Dijon, Besançon. We wound up in Besançon, which was the end of the mainline run. Before the mainline train went into Switzerland, we got off there, and she went home, either from one of the major stops, I think probably Besançon. Okay, then we had to wait until that night to take a bus to a little place called Meij near the Swiss border, and we had to stay awake all day. We'd been up for 48 hours by this time, starting to get a bit punchy. And I don't recall having eaten very much. But when we got on the train at Paris to come east, there was no water available, normally speaking, in these train stations, drinking water or anything like that. We had a bottle of wine. We thought we'd open that. That would quench the thirst. Well, I tell you, I just about burned alive by the time that night was over. Thirsty? Of course, the wine didn't do a bit of good. It just made it worse. When we got on the train at Paris, it was jammed. The aisles were jammed. You couldn't move. And there were two compartments at the end that were empty. And they were reserved for German officers. And I tried the door on one. I couldn't get it. Harry, the American, had got on the train first, and he was down the aisle about a third of the way, and there were a whole bunch of seething people between him and us. And I told Madame Legrand, you know, just to hang on a minute or two, we'd get into one of these compartments. So I was able to pick the lock. I opened the door, I didn't want to open the door until we could get Harry's attention, get him back, so that we got the two seats next to the aisle, and then there's enough room for one other person. But there were people in the baggage racks. Oh, I'll tell you, it's an interesting trip.
Why do you insist on the seats next to the aisle?
Next to the window.
Next to the window.
There's a door there. It's always nice to be able to get out, even if the train's doing 40 miles an hour. It did not travel fast in those days. I guess the train tracks were getting into poor condition. The train's engines themselves were getting tired, and they took it pretty easy. So you could really get off with any kind of luck at all, so as long as you didn't jump off when you're going over a trestle. See, at night you can't see a lot.
What was his strategy? Just to sleep and not talk? Presumably
it didn't matter then. Everybody was... I don't recall sleeping. Maybe we nodded a little bit, but you're on that train. Well, I think we must have left around dusk and got into Besançon around wee small hours, maybe just before daylight. And we're up all this time, and everybody was sort of nodding and dozing, and nobody asked for any identification.
And they were French people, presumably.
They're all Frenchmen, yeah. There were,
do you think that they took you for Frenchmen?
Oh, sure. Why should they take us for anything else?
Well, they'd only take you for Frenchmen if you didn't open your mouth, presumably.
Well, then they'd take me for Flemish.
Okay.
Me. Ron, I don't know. He spoke much better French than I did. He understood the language better, but I didn't know enough myself to be able to identify accents. Mm-hmm. But and Harry didn't speak anything. So he just kept quiet. I can remember just getting on the train, too, in amongst all this mob of people. Two German soldiers suddenly realized they were on the wrong train. And they had their packs and the whole thing. And from the commotion going on, one of them had said that, if this isn't our train, if we don't get on the right train, that they'd be, on the carpet, because they don't tolerate mistakes. You're supposed to be at point B, be there. So these guys were on their own. Well, he had his pack. He couldn't get it on. There were too many people around, so I helped him on with his pack and readjusted it and fixed them all up. And I thought to myself, he's just a young kid, too. And I thought, I wonder what he would really think if he knew the Allied Airman was helping him on with his pack. Oh, a few little late moments, but... The getting into the compartment was the point I remember, and the other was the bottle of wine and being so thirsty. And when we, at one of the stations where we changed, I think probably Dole or Dijon was a major junction for the rail lines. And we were sitting in the waiting room there, and because there weren't many seats around, we grabbed what we could. And Harry was sitting by himself. And he didn't, as I say, he didn't speak French. And there was a bit of a space beside him, not much, but a little bit. And a fellow in the uniform as a station attendant came up and asked him if that seat was taken, and he reached for his fake passport. And I just about had I just stopped. And the guy next to him said no. So Harry just sort of crawled back in his shell and said nothing. Well, we got to the village of Meige, and the contact we had there we were unable to discover. There was somebody there who was waiting for us, but I think it had been done by remote control. Things were so tight and everybody was so careful that they weren't about to take any chances they didn't have to, and I think that any connections that might have been made would have been a bit doubtful.
What were your instructions to do when you got to this village?
Well, we were to have, I don't remember now whether it was a store or a cafe or something. We were to go in and ask for Bruno or Joe or Sam or somebody, and then walk out, and then they would know to pick us up down the street or some little trick like that. But we couldn't even find the place in question. And, of course, it's dark and it's blackout and it's winter. Now, it's right, this is about the 22nd of December, and cold. Oh, it was cold. We did have a bit of luck. I don't remember what prompted us to go into a garage. Well, I think we went into the garage to find out when the bus left. And it was dark, and the chap that was working on one of the buses, and he said, "Why do you want to bus to this little village?" Wasn't even a village, just a crossroads by the border. He said, "You know that's a forbidden zone." And I said, "Well, we understand. We don't want to cause you any trouble." And he said, "Where are you going now?" He said, "The bus doesn't leave till 7 in the morning." And he said, "Well, we'll wait around." He said, "You want to sleep in the back of one of the buses?" So we thanked him very much. And, of course, an unheated bus in an unheated garage, and, oh, it was perishing cold. Finally, 7 o'clock came, and I've left out one bus ride. We got off the train at Besançon, and we had to wait all day for the bus to Meige. That's right. And I remember I went in and I got the tickets. 3 tickets for Meige. And I paid the gal. No sweat. There were a lot of people milling around, and there was no, except that she said, "Huh?" And I had to shout it, which I didn't want to do. That was Besançon for sure. I remember now. And we waited around. It was around 4 or 5 o'clock we bought the tickets, and it didn't leave until just about dark. And I don't know how long that bus ride took, but we were standing. It was that jammed, and I was starting to hallucinate. Now, we were all pooped, and everybody in the bus was jabbering, and it was coming through to me like English. I thought, I'm hearing things. I was that tired. At least I had enough sense not to answer anybody. But I can understand how a guy might start to ramble. Because as far as I was concerned, everybody in the bus was speaking English. And I guess my brain was so tired that reflex was starting to take over. However, and it was then that in the middle of the night that we arrived at this little Meige where we finally did get our heads down in the back of that cold bus. And the next morning, we went out to the little crossroads where the bus driver had been told by the other fellow where to drop us off. And we'd been told which way to head to get there. And that was good, Jen.
Who had told you to head in that direction and for that crossroads? If you hadn't met the courier that was supposed to pick you up, your contact in Meige.
Oh, we were playing it by ear now.
Do you have a map?
No, I don't think so, but we knew pretty well where Meige was in relation to the frontier and this sort of thing. And the fellow that was working in the bus station, or in the bus garage that night, said, "If you want to get across," he said, "it's not easy," but he told us which way to go and where to get off the bus. And then he told the driver, "Let these guys off at such and such a place." And I don't recall paying for that ride either.
So they knew what you were doing and who you were.
Oh, yeah, sure. So anyhow, in the morning, this thing took off, and I guess it must have been around 10, 11 o'clock, something like that in the morning. And now we know we're in the zone, and we're on a patrol path, so it's getting a little touchy. Now, we made an arrangement with one another that if anybody got stopped by a patrol or ran into a problem, The others were to split. No heroics. Don't try and make like Errol Flynn here. This is no movie. Leave them to it. And others are to try to get away. So we had come along the trail, and there was a little road, a little country road, not much more than one vehicle wide. And it was wooded, and there was a bit of a bank. And we dropped down over the bank, and Harry said, well, I'll nip across, and if it's clear, I'll motion you to come over. Well, he walked across, and he motioned us back. And he thought, uh-oh, something not too good here. And as luck would have it, it was just a Jerry Feltwebel. Wasn't on patrol, he was just going down to the village, I guess. And he spotted Harry, and he went in after the woods with him, and he got out his pistol, and we hear a shot. So we thought, well, we're not going to solve anything now. So I climbed up the bank, grabbed a hold of a tree, and I pulled Ron up. And well, this is when the German was still walking down the road. We'd seen him, and just before he went in after Harry, he didn't see us. And to see two guys as big as we were trying to hide behind a 6-inch tree trunk must have been comical to watch. And as he walked along, we'd turn behind it. Anyhow, after the war, Harry told me what happened. This fella came in and into the wood after him with his pistol. And Harry, they had very small caliber pistols, short barrels. They're strictly for in one room. You couldn't do any damage beyond that. But when he fired, he hit Harry in the arm. And Harry thought, well, I got to go for broke now. So he jumped on this guy, and Harry's pretty big. And he hit him, and he went down, but he wouldn't stay down. Very foolish of this German. He should have laid down nice and quiet and let it go at that. And Harry picked up his head, or his collar, and went to bash his head on the ground. And he said, the German said, ah, nine. And bang, he got it. And he said he had to hit him about 3 times before he'd quit. Well, then there was nothing for it. He had to get out of there because now he's up for being shot, you know, laying hands on a German officer. So he had to make it across the line. And he stumbled down a bank, and there was the river. Now, it was one of the places where there was access to the river without falling off a cliff.
Was the river a border? Was that the border?
Yeah, it was a border. And there was a bridge, and there was a German soldier patrolling the bridge, looking upstream. And Harry's just downstream, and it was shallow enough that he could wade and stumble across this thing. So he thought, well, here we go. And he just made for the other side. He said it was maybe 20 feet across. Ran up into the woods in behind a couple of trees, and then he said he just sat down and had at it. He thought that was the greatest thing that since sliced bread. He was in Switzerland.
So you were really proud at this point.
Oh, yes. Yeah. We, prior to this, we ducked one patrol. They had dogs with them, but I think the dogs were just there for effect because a trained dog would have known that there were people right there because we weren't 15 feet from them behind a bush. But anyhow, so Ron and I pressed on. And we started heading south. And that would be paralleling the Swiss border. We did at one time see a farmer over on the other side working around in his barnyard, thinking, oh, just that close. And the weather was starting to turn a bit miserable. And we stopped at one place. And there were two or three young fellows working in the farm and in the woods around the farm. I think they were chopping firewood or cutting firewood and loading it on a sled or a... There was snow about by now. And taking it back to their place. And they had horses, a team of horses. And we were talking to them, and I, looking back on it, I think we should have asked to stay. We asked them if we could get something to patch our shoes. I had a pair of ersatz shoes, and the paper was just coming apart, and I was just about on my bare feet. And we messed around in their tack room, you call it that, and he found some bits and pieces of leather, and I don't know how we tried to Mickey Mouse my shoes back together, but it wasn't too good. Ron had a pair of the escape boots that the RAF came up with near the end. It was an ordinary, heavy-duty, good-quality Oxford, but with a felt or a suede top. And then the lining, sheepskin lining in the suede top, you cut that open and you had your maps and that sort of thing in there and your money. But when you first get shot down, the idea would be to cut the tops off and then you've got a good pair of hiking boots. And they were good shoes, especially for somebody who's walking around in these paper jobs. Looking at those shoes made me green with envy, I'll tell you. Anyhow, we did not ask to stay there, and I think we might have been quite safe. They were off the beaten track, and you didn't get much collaboration activity going on with people out in the farm, very little of it. And it's unlikely that we would have been turned in, but we're getting so super suspicious now that it wasn't... We weren't taking this risk. So we carried on, and later that night, this would be around 5 o'clock, it's starting to get dusk and it's cold, and we went up to another farm, a fellow by the name of Hippolyte Gatois. And to this day, Ron still keeps in touch with him, or the last I heard. I think the old man must be dead now, but the son. And they had one of the typical French farmhouses where the sod floor and the kitchen, and I presume their bedroom would be in the loft above it. The barn, you go through a door and you're in the barn. It's all one building. And they gave us a little bit to eat, not much. He said, here, you can sleep in the hay. Well, we flipped a coin to see who'd go to sleep first, and this hurt Hippolyte's feelings. And I think finally we both, well, I don't think we could have stayed awake if we wanted to, but this is where Ron's stamina came in. Boy, he was a tough little squirt. He was 32. No, he wasn't. Correction. He was 29. I was 21. But he was a little on the top of the age group for air crew. Anyhow, the next morning we got up, and he gave us a piece of bread and cheese. And I thought, oh, this is great. I was going to get stuck into this. Oh, he says, that's for your lunch. He said, but to send you on your way, he said, he got out 3 shot glasses. He poured us all a shot. He said, this is, you know, vive la France and good luck. And so he knocked this stuff back. And I swear it was turpentine. I thought he got it out of the wrong jar. I said, I was being funny. I said, what do you make this out of, wood? He says, oh, yeah. He said, we make it out of pine. And I guess it was the next thing, pine sap. He said, well, it was turpentine. But it didn't seem to hurt him. And it gave you a nice, warm feeling, you know, on an empty stomach.
No breakfast?
No.
You didn't get a breakfast?
No, 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 that's your lunch. Well, we carried on all that day. We thought, we'll try for Neuchâtel, I think is the name of the place. And we didn't know which way to go, whether to try and catch a train out of there and head for Spain, or whether to try the border again in Switzerland, because if you go to Spain, you just run into the same problems. Why go clear across the country? And we went into a restaurant, or a bistro, and ordered up a beer apiece. It's now dark again, it's night. We've been hiking all night, or all day. And getting a mite peckish, but there was no food, no good asking for food, so we ordered a beer each, just to come in someplace where we're out of the weather, if nothing else, because it was sort of half drizzling, half sleet, and then it wouldn't do anything, but it was anything but pleasant, especially at night. And we, this is in a little village. I've threatened to go back there and retrace that, because I'm a little confused. It's the type of place that would not be into big highway development or anything like that. It's unlikely. We left there, and the road that we were on went beside the river. And we couldn't get off the road. There was a cliff on each side, one going up and one going down. And there was a railroad track ran along by the road. And at one point, my feet were just killing me by this time, and frozen stiff. And we just had on, I had a suit. That's all. I didn't have an overcoat. Neither one of us did. But I got so tired that I laid out on a plank covered with snow just to get the weight off my feet. And Ron tromped around in the snow, waving his, beating his arms. Well, that only lasted about 5 minutes. It wasn't very restful. But it was my feet that were, if I didn't get off them, I was going to go nuts. And the road, it wasn't bitterly cold then because of the snow and the sleet. I would say it was just borderline freezing because there were bits of slush and bits of frozen ground. And one car passed us in the night, and I don't think that was very good news. We couldn't escape it. He didn't stop. He just went right on past. And at one point along that road, on the cliff face that we were walking beside, there was a cave with doors in it and stained glass windows. No building at all. It might have been a creech. It might have been, we didn't even try the door. And it was